changes when he finally tells her about the injury he received in the field, an injury he had downplayed with his family. Lying on a gurney covered in blood, most of it not his own, he was offered last rites and then left alone. Suddenly she understands how he might be injured by her sudden absence. She also understands his refusal to take pain medication when he further confides that he believes his pain is a just punishment for his mistakes while on mission. We need to be able to thaw out our feelings and share them with our lovers. This means that our loved ones, for a moment, also have to see the dragon's face. This is the only way that they can really understand our pain and need, hold us tight, and help us heal. The Canadian peacekeeper and the soldier wounded in Iraq did what you have learned to do in this book. With support from their partners, they allowed themselves to touch and share their emotional worlds. They did not share all the details of their ordeals, but they learned to express the core of their pain and struggle to their loved ones. These couples were able to look at how the husband's experience changed him, what he needed to heal, and how he could best ask his spouse for connection and comfort. The wives were able to share how difficult the deployment time had been for them and how desperate they felt when their partners were so distant and angry on their return. When we work with soldiers and their spouses, we see them both as warriors. One battled in a foreign field, the other fought on the home front. Whether we explicitly share what has happened to us or not, trauma is always a couple issue. Partners feel the sting and stress as they watch their lovers cope with their wounds, and they also grieve their changed relationships. Marcy, whose husband is a firefighter, tells me, "After that big fire where four of his buddies died, I started having nightmares. They would always start with me getting a phone call or a police officer coming to the door, and I would know that Hal was dead. I would wake up in a sweat and just hold on to his back in the bed. I'd cry silently so as not to wake him. I knew he was having a real hard time with what had happened. It helped a lot when we started to open up and talk about it. He told me he was hurting, but he still loved being a firefighter. Then I got to tell him how hard it is sometimes to be a firefighter's wife." Carol, who was in a massive car accident 2 years ago and is still in chronic pain and disabled, becomes very impatient when her partner, Laura, silently weeps but will not talk about her feelings. Carol accuses her of being cold. Finally, in a quiet voice, Laura is able to admit, "Okay, I'm lost. I cannot deal with all the medical appointments, lawyers, different diagnoses, and trying to take care of the kids on my own. And I'm so stressed out that I find myself resenting you for getting hurt. How can I tell you that I hurt too when you are in such pain? And that when you get irritable, all I can do is leave the scene so as not to explode and hurt you more. Maybe I need you to acknowledge that this didn't just happen to you. It happened to us. That accident changed my life forever. I need recognition, too." Turning to a loved one. How does a sense of secure attachment help us cope with trauma? Dan and Mavis had been sent to see me by doctors worried that their frequent arguments would impede Dan's recovery from the terrible stroke he had suffered 3 years earlier. The consequences of his illness were severe. Dan, 46, had lost his career, and the couple had almost lost their home. Unable to speak for a year after the stroke, Dan could now talk, but only very slowly, and he walked with difficulty. Halfway through the session, I realized that this couple doesn't need any help from me at all. They have each other. They are affectionate and responsive, and Mavis glows with pride when she describes how Dan has begun a new business by making beautiful furniture. I ask how they coped with his stroke. "Oh, we just held each other and cried for about 2 months," Mavis says. "Everyone wanted us to make concrete plans, but we just needed to grieve together. There was so much loss." Mavis and Dan are helping each other heal by giving each other a safe place to mourn. Both were initially overwhelmed, but together they've been able to come to terms with their loss. Dan talks about how Mavis has always reassured him that she will be there for him and that she believes in his strength and his ability to find a way through it all. "You are a haven and a comfort for Dan and a source of confidence and hope, and that has helped him move forward step by step," I observe. Mavis ruefully admits that she was not always kind and caring. Sometimes she, like Dan, got frustrated and irritable. "I lost it with him one day and blurted out that he just had to try harder to walk because I just couldn't take care of everything, and he just refused to look at me or try to talk to me for a whole day." Dan smiles and adds, "So in the evening, I told her that I was all gimpy and pretty useless to her, and she was so lovely that she could always find another man, but she just said that she was stuck on me, even if I was real gimpy." When Dan cannot find the energy to struggle further, Mavis finds it for him. She'd say, "Just sing me a line from our song. Just do it for me." That was how I started to learn to talk again. Mavis sees the best in her wounded husband and reassures him he's still precious to her, wounds and all. She relentlessly gives him the message that she believes that he can improve and create a new life for himself. She blocks Dan's descent into hopelessness and depression. She gives him a reason to keep trying. I notice that even though Dan speaks slowly and slurs some of his words, the story they tell me is very much a joint creation. We know that part of healing from trauma is being able to grasp a cataclysmic event and shape it into a coherent story, one that makes sense out of chaos and creates a vision of renewed control. When one partner puts a negative spin on incidents, the other moves in to comfort and show the larger picture. Mavis confides, "After a few months when lots of the medical support seemed to fade out, I felt so much pressure to cope. I became obsessed with the idea that it was going to happen again. All I could think about was Dan's pills and avoiding all the risk factors for stroke. So we sat and went over all the things the doctors had said, and we decided that the stroke most likely happened because of his high blood pressure and his history. It runs in his family. So we picked the person in his family who lived to 87, his Uncle Austin, and looked at how he lived his life. We made 4 changes and decided that we had the bases covered as far as preventing a relapse. We listed all the things we had already done to cope and how they had turned out. I was less anxious after that." The main thing they had done was face down the monster together. A secure bond helps us deal with and heal trauma by soothing our pain and giving us comfort. Physical and emotional closeness actually calms our nervous system and helps us find our balance again, physiologically and emotionally. To a wounded partner, a lover's comfort is as desperately needed and powerful as any drug. Sometimes we do not offer compassion because we're scared and we think that our emotional response will somehow weaken our partner further. We do not understand the power of the love we have to give. Helping us hold on to hope. Our relationships give us a reason to keep struggling. Dan tells me quietly, "If Mavis had moved away from me, I would have just given in and given up." It was Mavis who gave Dan a woodworking kit about a year after his stroke. The kit had started Dan on a whole new career, and Mavis was so very proud of him. Reassuring us that the new person we've become is still valued and loved. We need to be told it's not a mark of failure to be overwhelmed by difficult events. Helping us make sense of what has happened. By sharing our stories, we can begin to find meaning and create order from chaos and recover a sense of control. Emotional connection is crucial to healing. In fact, trauma experts overwhelmingly agree that the best predictor of the impact of any trauma is not the severity of the event, but whether we can seek and take comfort from others. But not all of us can handle the dragon with the finesse of Dan and Mavis. As we have seen in previous chapters, we often miss each other's attachment cues. We don't see the longing for emotional comfort or connection. We move into action mode, solving logistical and practical problems, but leaving our lover alone and hurting. Or we fail to send out a clear call for the comfort we need. Our need, our hunger for connection, our sense of isolation when we cannot find a safe haven, our loss of emotional balance, all these are exacerbated by the emotional chaos that monstrous events instill in us. And when we cannot find love and connection, the emotional chaos deepens. Trauma's echoes. Sometimes our emotions and the signals we send get confused because the echoes of trauma are too loud. These reverberations can also frighten and confuse our partner. Flashbacks, extreme sensitivity, and hair trigger reactivity, irritability and anger, hopelessness, and severe withdrawal are hallmarks of trauma. People who are dealing with trauma's echoes often hold back from telling their partner what is happening. They feel that they should be able to deal with it on their own, or that their spouse would not understand. The partner then takes these symptoms personally and becomes distressed and defensive. Zena and Will are having a fight about what exactly happened to derail their lovemaking the night before. Will is offended by Zena's rejection, and Zena is silent and tearful. Finally, Zena tells Will that as she lay in bed and listened to his footsteps coming up the stairs, she was suddenly back in the parking garage where she was raped. She heard again the heavy footsteps coming up behind her, and she was flooded with fear. The last thing she wanted then was to make love. As she tells Will this, his face changes from tight resentment to compassion and caring. Zena's confession was crucial. It kept Will from taking her rejection of him as a personal affront and becoming angry, which would have confirmed her sense that she must always be on guard. Zena explains to him that her body reacts as if she is still in danger, even though she knows that she's safe at home. Will is able to comfort Zena as she weeps for her lost sense of safety and control. It's natural for our nervous system to vibrate with shock for a while after meeting the dragon. Our brain is on alert, watching out for signs of danger and flipping into high gear at the slightest uncertainty. Not only do we have flashbacks, but we feel hyped. We can't sleep, and we become unpredictably and easily irritated. Unfortunately, this irritation often ends up being directed at our partner. Our partner then also becomes tense and anxious. Traumatic stress infuses the whole relationship. Ted, who has completed 3 deployments in Iraq, loses it when another driver cuts him off and he has to move onto the shoulder of the road. The edges of the road are dangerous territory in Iraq. Ted chases the offending driver for miles at high speed, at one point bumping the back fender of his car. He swears and curses at his wife Doreen when she tells him to slow down and calm down. Much later, he is able to look at what happened and to apologize. And together they talk about different ways to handle this kind of situation. The line between being anxious and exploding into anger is thin and easily crossed at the best of times. After trauma, this line becomes even thinner. Ted finds it hard to deal with Doreen's feedback that his temper scares her. They talk it through and come up with a few phrases that Doreen can use to signal Ted that hype and fight is taking control, and to help him calm down. They feel closer. Staying isolated. Going it alone after trauma, shutting down all emotions in an attempt to control the emotional turmoil, is disastrous for survivors and their relationships. It drives the survivor's partner into a spiral of panic and insecurity and weakens the couple's bond. It also walls off the survivor from all positive healing emotions, including the joy of feeling close to a loved one. Barricading emotions is difficult, and survivors often resort to drugs or alcohol to help relieve the tumult, which only further undermines any chance for emotional connection. Joe, a long-serving police officer who had lost his buddy in a savage shootout, had been on sick leave for 3 months. He realized how cut off he had become when his little girl had her 6th birthday party and a buddy arrived to visit. His buddy told Joe how very lucky he was to have a family who obviously loved him very much, and that this must be helping him deal with the death of his friend. Joe agreed that he was lucky, but he felt absolutely nothing. Later that night, he was able to open up to his wife, Megan. He told her that he felt that it was his fault that his buddy had died. He was ashamed and afraid to feel anything. His wife's love and validation gave Joe the most powerful antidote to such shame and fears. Joe and Megan were able to get back together fairly quickly. But what happens when trauma survivors stay emotionally shut down? Trauma's echoes cannot dissipate. The continuing reverberations gradually erode connection and trust with loved ones. Partners need to recognize that avoiding emotion sets their relationship up for descent into demon dialogues. "Joe," I had warned, "there is a trap here. The more stressed and out of control you feel, the more you shut down. It's hard to heal that way. Life becomes a search for ways to stay numb and avoid the dragon. And if you cannot feel, your wife is shut out. She cannot support you. In fact, she's alone. Your relationship falters, and you see this and get even more distressed. Round and round it goes." The hopelessness that survivors of trauma feel often leads them into actions that drive their partners away when they need them the most. Jane and Ed are both staring out of my office window. This is their 4th session with me. In the initial phone contact, Jane told me that the problem is that she feels alone in her marriage. They are here now because in their most recent fights, Jane, usually the more engaged, demanding partner, has added a new twist to their negative dance. She has stated that the only way out of all the hurt she's feeling may be suicide. Unfortunately, this final desperate protest creates even more distance between her and Ed. He is generally the more withdrawn partner, but now he feels threatened and confused and has retreated even further. Jane admits that she constantly bitches at Ed and agrees with me that this is a protest about his continuing distancing from her. He tells me that he responds to her irritability by coming home from work later and later. This young couple had been happy until 2 years ago, when Jane had opened her door to a young man who turned out to be a brutal robber. He had viciously knifed her, and she had nearly bled to death. She had spent several months in the hospital and was left in chronic pain. Ed thinks Jane should be over it all by now, but her nightmares of the attack are only getting worse, and she's talking about killing herself. We discuss their negative cycle and how Jane's threats about suicide are really pleas to her husband to help her escape the terrible feelings that haunt her. I can hear the echoes of her trauma in their fights, but Ed doesn't agree. He tells me, "Well, for sure, everything has changed between us since that attack happened. But I don't understand how that translates into us fighting all the time. Like the fight we just had. She went totally nuts on me just because I forgot to turn my cell phone on for about 2 hours when I was playing golf. And now these threats to hurt herself. I just can't cope with that." He lets out a huge sigh, and Jane begins to tear up. Jane has been very reluctant to tell Ed about the details of her attack, or that she still has frequent flashbacks. She felt blamed by him for being fooled into opening the door to her attacker. I suddenly remembered something specific about a phone in her story of that terrible day. "Wait a minute," I said. "Jane, Didn't you tell me that during the attack, when you were lying on the floor and beginning to lose consciousness, you could see a phone on the rug beside the coffee table? But you couldn't make your body respond. You couldn't reach for it. She nods, so I continue. And I remember that you said that even though you were passing out and thought that you were dying, you kept fighting to reach the phone to call Ed, and you told yourself, if I can just call Ed, he will come and save me. Isn't that right? Jane weeps and murmurs, but I couldn't get to him. Yes, but the phone was the only hope you had. It was your lifeline. So now when you try to call Ed and he has his cell phone turned off, I guess panic swells up. You can't reach him again, right? Jane cries, and Ed, with a sudden look of understanding on his face, runs his hands through his hair. Jane and Ed then move into a new conversation about how when something reminds her of her attack, she desperately needs to connect with him. When she cannot reach him, her body literally responds as if she were back on the floor with her life ebbing away. She tells Ed, "When I realized your phone was off and I was alone, I freaked out. My heart was racing and I couldn't breathe." She had tried to get Ed to understand her desperation, her sense that her life was on the line, by announcing that she might as well commit suicide. But this threat overwhelmed Ed and made it even harder for him to respond. Once Ed and Jane are able to move into ARE conversations, they create a secure base from which to deal with Jane's trauma. Ed realizes that it does not help to downplay Jane's hurt and fear. If he gets overwhelmed, it's better for him to say so than to simply move away. As their relationship improves, Ed becomes less depressed, and Jane's nightmares and flashbacks dramatically diminish. But more than this, Ed has learned that he can give Jane what no one else can, the comforting knowledge that her pain is seen and understood, the reassurance that she is not alone with her terror, and the support to let her life move forward. While trauma survivors desperately need their loved one's support, they often react in ways that push that help away. That can skew survivors' love relationships for decades, even for a lifetime. But if couples can reach out and face trauma together, they can put the dragon to rest. It's been a long time since Vietnam, at least for those of us who didn't have to go or wait for someone to come home. For Doug, it was just yesterday. He is still the cocky 23-year-old lieutenant who led his Army Rangers into peril and managed to bring them all home safe. Well, almost all home safe. Doug is a recovering alcoholic on a disability pension and is on his fourth marriage, which isn't going well. He says that he's sure that his wife Pauline is going to leave him, and maybe he's right. Most of the time when they're together, they're locked in the protest polka demon dialogue. She complains, and he withdraws. Pauline, a little younger than Doug and never married before, says angrily that they're simply drifting apart. She tells Doug, "I love you, but your short fuse has me so stressed out. You're either all riled up or gone. You disappear emotionally. If I try to tell you how much I need you, you just flip out. I'm out of options here." He looks around with a wry smile and says, "See, I knew she was going to leave me, and I'll be ready. You have to be ready to deal with the worst that can happen." That may be a good motto for a soldier, but not for a lover. Pauline and Doug discuss their protest polka in more detail. The steps are quicker and more extreme than in most of the couples I see. Dealing with trauma adds an extra spin to negative cycles. I begin to understand why their protest polka happens when Doug talks about what he learned in Nam. "That's easy," he says. "Never reveal fear and never be wrong. If you're wrong, somebody dies, and it will be your fault. These two rules saved my life. They're etched deep into my soul." It's not hard to understand how these rules translate into Doug shutting down and being hypervigilant for any intimation that Pauline thinks him less than perfect. A key breakthrough moment occurs in this couple's raw spot conversation when they share their vulnerabilities with each other. Doug not only admits to hiding safe in the dark tunnel, but tells his wife that his main fear is that she will see who he really is. Pauline, in turn, tells him, "I yell and demand because I can't find you. That is scary. I love you, scars of numb and all."
"You wouldn't love me if you knew what I did there," he shoots back. "I brought my boys home, but no one should have to do the things we did."
He reveals that he's never told anyone about a terrible firefight and the orders he gave that haunt him and engulf him in shame.
"If you knew, you would walk. No one can love anyone who did those things," he says.
After a few more sessions, during a hold-me-tight conversation, Doug is finally able to disclose the basic facts of his secret shame. He does not tell Pauline all the details. He reveals just enough to check out his worst fear, that no one can love him. Pauline responds with love and compassion. "You're a fine and loving man. You did your best, and you did what you had to do, and you've paid for it every day since. And right now, I love you even more because you took a risk like this and opened up to me," she says. Doug has to break his own invincibility rule to never show any weakness. He explains that in battle, fear paralyzes. Only perfect performance guarantees safety. As he tells his wife,
"If you're perfect, never make mistakes. Only then will the killing stop. Only then will you get home."
She weeps and tells him, "But you're never perfect enough, so you never come home, even when I'm standing here with open arms longing for you." Then it is his turn to weep. Doug and Pauline's relationship is truly transformed when Pauline tells him softly, "I need you to let me in, to come close. I love you, and I need you so." But Doug doesn't hear the invitation. He hears an indictment. He stares at his shoes and says,
"Well then, you're just too demanding."
Pauline's face crumbles in despair, but then Doug stops himself and looks up at her.
"What did you say?" he asks. "I heard you say that I wasn't doing my job, that I was blowing it with you. If you were happy, you wouldn't have to ask for those things, but what did you say to me?"
In the next few minutes, Doug understands for the first time that it is the voice of his own fear he hears saying, "She can't want you. You will blow it and she will leave." This voice drowns out Pauline's words of love and twists them into criticism. Pauline takes him in her arms. He tells her,
"I need you, too. I need your reassurance. I want to be there for you, too."
After 40 years, Doug finally gets to come home. The biggest obstacle. With all traumas, chronic fear and anger are problematic after effects, but the biggest sticking point in relationship problems, in my opinion, is the feeling of shame that afflicts survivors. After trauma, we feel scarred, contaminated, or just plain bad. We feel responsible for the terrible things that happened to us and unworthy of care and attention. How can we ask for what we do not deserve? At the beginning of our sessions, my client Jane tells me, "To be honest, all this talking about the relationship is a waste of time. Who would want to be with me anyway? Since the assault, I'm just a disgusting mess." At such moments, we need our loved ones to take the edge off this poisonous feeling and reassure us. Ed tells his wife,
"You are my precious one. I nearly lost you. It hurts me to hear you say that. You were wounded. There's no shame in that. And now I know how to hold you so you don't have to be so afraid."
We need our partner to be a safe haven and also a true witness to our pain, to assure us we're not to blame for what happened and that we're not weak for being helpless and overwhelmed.
A secure love relationship acts as a protective shield when we face monsters and dragons and helps us heal after the dragon has gone. At the end of therapy, Doug decides to contact all the guys who were with him in Vietnam, even though he worries that they will remember him as a hard-nosed tyrant. He says, "In the end, the real problem is that you have seen the dark side, the thing that we're all afraid of, and your world is different from everyone else's. You're on the outside, by yourself. A few people might throw you a line now and then." He turns to Pauline. "But my love, you just came right in. You wanted me with all my monsters. With you, I belong again." Out of pain can come strength and a deeper sense of connection if we can learn to use the power of love. Someday, after mastering winds, waves, tides, and gravity, we shall harness the energy of love, and for the second time in the history of the world, man will have discovered fire, wrote the French Christian mystic and writer Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. This fire is not the one that burns and terrifies, but the one that gives light and warmth. It is love that can change not just our relationships, but our world. Ultimate connection. Love as the final frontier. And did you get what you wanted from this life even so?
I did.
And what did you want?
To call myself beloved, to feel myself beloved on the earth.
Raymond Carver. Learning how to nurture the bonds of love is an urgent task. Loving connection provides the dependable web of intimacy that allows us to cope with life and to live life well. And that is what gives our life its meaning. For most of us, on our deathbeds, it is the quality of our connection with our precious ones that will matter most. Instinctively, we know that those who grasp the imperatives of attachment live better lives, yet our culture encourages us to compete rather than connect. Even though we're programmed by millions of years of evolution to relentlessly seek out belonging and intimate connection, we persist in defining healthy people as those who do not need others. This is especially dangerous at a time when our sense of community is daily being eroded by an endless preoccupation with getting more done in less time and filling our lives with more and more goods. We're building a culture of separateness that is at odds with our biology. We know, as Thomas Lewis and his colleagues state so well in their book A General Theory of Love, that if we feed and clothe a human infant, but deprive him of emotional contact, he will die. But we have been taught to believe that adults are a different animal. However did we get here? Psychiatrist Jonathan Shea, in his book on the trauma of combat, Odysseus in America, reminds us that there are two momentous human universals, that we are all born helpless and dependent, and that we are all mortal, and we know it. The only healthy way to deal with this vulnerability is to reach out and hold each other. Then, calmed and strengthened, we can walk out into the world. The attachment perspective recognizes that our need for emotional connection with others is absolute. Thousands of studies in developmental psychology with mother and child, research on adult bonding, and the investigations of modern neuroscience confirm that when we are in close relationships, we are truly interdependent. We're not like separate little planets revolving around each other. This healthy dependence is the essence of romantic love. The bodies of lovers are linked in a neural duet. One person sends out signals that alter the hormone levels, cardiovascular function, body rhythms, and even immune system of the other. In loving connection, the cuddle hormone oxytocin floods lovers' bodies, bringing a calm joy and the sense that everything is right with the world. Our bodies are set up for this kind of connection. Even our identity is a kind of duet with those closest to us.
A loving relationship expands our sense of who we are and our confidence in ourselves. You wouldn't be listening to this book had I not found a way to plug into my husband's belief that I could write it, and my ability to hold on to his reassuring words kept me writing rather than walking away. Our loved ones do indeed come into our hearts and minds, and when they do, they transform us. The quality of the love we receive puts us on a certain track. Assess how safely connected to mom 1-year-olds are when put in the strange situation, and you can predict how socially competent these children will be in elementary school and how close their friendships will be in adolescence, according to Jeff Simpson of the University of Minnesota. A secure connection to mom and the closeness of these early friendships also forecast the quality of these individuals' love relationships at age 25. We are our relationship history. How does love work? To achieve a lasting, loving bond, we have to be able to tune in to our deepest needs and longings and translate them into clear signals that help our lovers respond to us. We have to be able to accept love and to reciprocate. Above all, we have to recognize and accept the primal code of attachment rather than attempting to dismiss and bypass it. In many love relationships, attachment needs and fears are hidden agendas, directing the action but never being acknowledged. It's time to acknowledge these agendas so that we can actively shape the love we so badly need. To shape love, we have to be open and responsive, emotionally as well as physically. We can see what love encompasses in studies of the fluffy little TT monkey conducted by Bill Mason and Sally Mendoza of the University of California. Females nurse their babies, but don't offer any other maternal responses. They do not groom or touch their infants. The true nurturer is the male, who assumes 80% of the infant care. It is the male who holds and carries the baby, who is emotionally engaged and is the safe haven. Baby TTs don't seem to mind at all when the mother is removed from the family for a while, but when the father is taken away, the infant's levels of the stress hormone cortisol soar. In my office, more emotionally distant partners sometimes tell me, "I do all kinds of things to show I care. I mow the lawn, bring in a good salary, solve problems, and I don't play around. Why is it that in the end these things don't seem to matter, and all that counts with my wife is that we don't talk about emotional stuff and cuddle?" I tell them, because that's just the way we're made. We need someone to pay real attention, to hold us tight, to come very close sometimes and respond to us in an emotional way that moves us, connects with us. Nothing compares with that. You need that, too. Have you forgotten? Connection is sweet. Holding is deeply calming and satisfying, whether we're receiving or giving. Most of us love to hold a baby. It feels so good, just as it feels good to hold our lover. But is attachment and bonding the whole ball of wax? Adult love also involves sexuality and caretaking. Attachment is the bottom line, the scaffold on which these other elements are built. The interconnections are obvious. Sexuality is best when there is a safe connection. The risk that is essential to eroticism does not come from constant superficial novelty, but from the ability to stay open to your partner in the moment. Caretaking and pragmatic support come naturally when we feel close and connected. When you love, you wish to do things for, Ernest Hemingway wrote. You wish to sacrifice for, you wish to serve. We know from research that secure partners are more sensitive to each other's needs for care. Rose and Bill, a grad school couple, fought about everything, but especially emotional connection and pragmatic supportiveness. Even at the conclusion of therapy, after they've made considerable progress, they get into a fight about the fact that he doesn't keep the pediatrician's number on his cell phone, although she has asked him to do just that. When the baby gets ill, she can't use his phone to call the doctor.
They finally find a way to step out of the argument.
When I can't find that number, I get scared, Rose says to Bill.
I need you to listen when I ask for stuff like that.
Bill now offers support. I hear you, he says. It's like you're saying to me, do you have my back? You need to depend on me here.
And you're a great mother to our kids. I have put the number on my phone and ordered you your own cell phone so this won't happen again. Maybe there are other ways I can support you here.
In a later session, Rose tells Bill that she no longer resents taking care of the kids in the evenings when he needs to study. Now that she feels closer to him, she actually enjoys bringing him coffee and listening to how he's doing with his courses. Being able to create a more secure bond frees up our attention so that we can tune into and actively support our loved one. In a romantic relationship, secure attachment, sexuality, and supportiveness all come together. Partners create a positive loop of closeness, responsiveness, caring, and desire. In his first counseling session, Charlie solemnly announced that he had hired a divorce lawyer. Now, a few months later, he tells me as his wife Sharon nods happily in agreement,
"We're a lot closer. I don't think we've ever been this close. Somehow, I just don't get so uptight and jealous anymore. I trust her. I can tell her when I need her help to set my mind at ease, and she can turn to me, too. We feel closer in bed. Sex is so much easier. I think we both feel desired and that we can ask for what we want. When we feel close like this, I like taking care of her. I like helping when her back hurts. I went and found her a little heating pad, and she's helping me to stop smoking. This is like a whole new relationship here."
But making love work is also accepting that even when it's good, it's always a work in progress. Just when you get it right, one of you changes. Ursula Le Guin, the novelist, reminds us that love does not sit there like a stone. It has to be made like bread, remade all the time, made new. The intention behind EFT is to offer couples a way to do just that. 20 years of research tells us that we have helped many different kinds of couples make their love, newlyweds and long married folks, gays and straights, the basically happy and the seriously distressed, traditional and unconventional, highly educated and blue-collar, reticent and effusive. We have found that EFT not only helps heal relationships, it creates relationships that heal. Partners who are depressed and anxious benefit enormously from the experience of supportive connection that a more loving relationship offers. If I had to summarize the lessons I've learned from all these couples, they would look like this. Our need for others to come close when we call, to offer us safe haven, is absolute. Emotional starvation is a reality. Feeling emotionally deserted, rejected, or abandoned sparks physical and emotional pain and panic. There are very few ways to cope with our pain when our primary needs for connection are not met. Emotional balance, calm, and vibrant joy are the rewards of love. Sentimental infatuation is the booby prize. There is no perfect performance in love or sex. Obsession with performance is a dead end. It is emotional presence that matters. In relationships, there is no simple cause and effect, no straight lines, only circles that partners create together. We pull each other into loops and spirals of connection and disconnection. Emotion tells us exactly what we need if we can listen to it and use it as a guide. We all hit the panic button at times. We lose our balance and slip into anxious controlling or numbing and avoiding modes. The secret is to not stay in these positions. It's too hard for your lover to meet you there. Key moments of bonding, when one person reaches for another and the other responds, take courage, but they are magical and transforming. Forgiving injuries is essential, and only happens when partners can make sense of their own hurt and know that their lover connects and feels that hurt with them. Lasting passion is entirely possible in love. The erratic heat of infatuation is just the prelude. An attuned loving bond is the symphony. Neglect will kill love. Love needs attention. Knowing your attachment needs and responding to those of your lover can make a bond last until death do us part. All the clichés about love, when people feel loved, they are freer, more alive, and more powerful, are truer than we ever imagined. Knowing all this, I still have to relearn these lessons every time I lose connection with a loved one. I still have to face that nanosecond of choice to blame, to try and grab control, to dismiss, to get revenge, to shut down and shut out, or to breathe deep and tune into my own and my loved one's emotions, to risk, to reach, to confide, to hold. A wider circle. When lovers are united in a strong and secure bond, it does more than enhance their connection to each other. The circle of loving responsiveness widens like the ripple from a stone dropped in a pool. Being in a loving relationship augments our caring and compassion for others, in our family and in our community. In the early research on attachment, Mary Ainsworth found that as early as 3 years of age, kids who are secure with their moms are more empathetic to others. When we don't have to worry about safety with our loved ones, we naturally have more energy to give to others. We see others more positively and are more willing to emotionally engage with them. Feeling loved and secure makes us kinder and more tolerant people. Psychologists Phil Shaver and Mario Michelanser have shown in their studies that simply pausing and recalling times when someone cared for you instantly reduces your hostility to people who are different from you, if only for a brief period. This supports the Buddhist meditation method for enhancing compassion by thinking on how one is loved by another. Science journalist Sharon Begley, in her book on neuroscience and Buddhism, quotes the Dalai Lama as saying that Tibetans in danger usually shout "mother" for comfort. This seems at least as useful as some of the more aggressive phrases we North Americans use. Love between lovers, love in families. We have known for decades that happy families start with happy relationships between partners. When we're stressed out and constantly fighting with our partner, it spills over into our relationships with our children. It's clear beyond all doubt that conflict between parents is bad for kids. When we're frustrated and anxious, the way we discipline our kids suffers. Mostly, we become harsher and more inconsistent, but it is more than just an issue of discipline. If we're struggling in an unhappy relationship, we're often off balance emotionally and find it harder to be open and really tuned in to our youngsters. Because we're not emotionally present for them, they miss out on our nurturing and guidance. Alice tells me, "I'm turning into this irritable, harsh person. I'm so drained by what Frank and I are going through. I just don't have the energy for the kids. When my youngest started to cry about being scared to go to school, I shouted at him. I feel awful about this. I've become a harridan, and Frank is distant with everyone. We have to solve this for everyone's sake." High levels of conflict in a marriage often precipitate behavioral and emotional problems in children, including depression. But conflict is not the only factor affecting youngsters. Partners' emotional distancing from each other also frequently leads to distancing from the kids. Psychologist Melissa Sturge Apple of the University of Rochester confirms this is especially true of fathers and their offspring. Her studies find that when men withdraw from their wives, they also often become unavailable to their children. If we think in positive terms, when we feel securely attached to our partner, we tend to find it easier to be good parents,
to provide a safe haven and secure base for our youngsters. Our kids then learn positive ways to deal with their emotions and connect with others. There's a mountain of scientific evidence that securely attached children are happier, more socially competent, and more resilient in the face of stress. The idea that one of the best things you can do for your child is to create a loving relationship with your partner is not sentimental, it's a scientific fact. But then therapists have been telling us for years that if we want to be really good parents, we must either have had secure loving childhoods or counseling to deal with less than loving childhoods. My experience is that even if we have childhoods that have left us with lots of emotional difficulties and we never go to see a therapist, creating a better marriage can turn us into better parents. Psychologist Deborah Cohn from the University of Virginia agrees. She finds that moms who are anxious and insecure about closeness, if they're married to responsive men who provide them with a safe connection, are able to be positive and loving with their kids. When we love each other well, we help each other parent well. When you have a safe connection in your relationship, you can pass that quality on, not just to your kid, but to your kid's future partners. Psychologist Rand Conger and colleagues from Iowa State University observed 193 families with adolescent children over a period of 4 years and found that the degree of warmth and supportiveness between parents and the quality of their parenting predicted how the children would relate to romantic partners 5 years later. The children of warmer and more supportive parents were warmer and more supportive with their partners, and their relationships were happier. When we love our partner well, we offer a blueprint for a loving relationship to our children and their partners. Better relationships between love partners are not just a personal preference, they are a social good. Better love relationships mean better families, and better, more loving families mean better, more responsive communities. Society. Loving families are the basis of a humane society. As the poet Roberto Sosa writes, "Blessed are the lovers, for theirs is the grain of sand that sustains the center of the seas. The widening circle of engagement with and responsiveness to others does not stop with our immediate loved ones or even with the future families they create. It continues to spread out, to help create more caring communities and ultimately a more caring world. Understanding our longing for love and how love works is crucial if we want to shape a world that allows those longings to be answered and reflects the best of our nature. A human being longs for, is wired for, connection with others. Our nature is to bond intimately with a precious few, but then, having learned the lessons of belonging, to connect with others, our friends, colleagues, our tribe. When we are at our best, we offer support and caring to others because we recognize that they are just like us, human and vulnerable. In fact, we rejoice in the fellowship that takes us out of our own small world and makes us part of the whole. I grew up in a small, less than affluent British town after World War II, where the sense that we all needed to pull together to survive was tangible. Everyone came to the pub, the clergyman, the commodore, the paper seller, the judge, the doctor, the clerk, the housewife, and the whore. Elderly villagers would spend all evening in one corner playing cards and discussing politics. Tramps who wandered from town to town would be given shelter, a beer, and a huge plate of my mother's bacon and eggs before they wandered on. Soldiers who broke down, overwhelmed with the memories of war, were taken into a back room, held, and comforted. Mourners were given a hug, a whiskey, and maybe a cheery out-of-tune song on the piano, courtesy of my grandmother. Of course, there was also fighting and dissension, prejudice and cruelty. But in the end, there was a sense that we all stood together. We knew that we needed each other. And most of the time, there were at least one or two of us who could manage to be compassionate. Feeling connected, feeling with someone, goes hand in hand with feeling for that person. We can learn sympathy and compassion for others from the Christian Bible, from the Quran, or from the teachings of the Buddha. But I think first we have to learn it and feel it in the tender embrace of a parent or a lover. Then perhaps we can actively and intentionally pass it on in ever-widening circles to the larger world. In fact, for centuries, poets and prophets have assured us that we would all be better off if we loved each other more, and that we should do just that. Most often this message is given as a set of moral rules and abstract ideas. Trouble is that it doesn't seem to have that much impact unless we're also emotionally touched, unless we feel a personal connection to another human being. Then we can tune in to their hurt and sadness as if it is our own. Like many of us, I find myself giving a little money to the relief funds for victims of earthquakes and other disasters. But it's hard to really respond to huge, overwhelming problems or to faceless crowds. For me, it's easier and much more satisfying to give more money every month to the families of two little girls in India who are registered with the Foster Parents Plan of the International Relief Agency Plan Canada. I have pictures of them. I know their names and the names of their villages. I know that one family now has a goat and that the other has clean water for the first time. I dream of going to visit them. I feel a connection to the stoic-looking mothers who stand beside these children in the photos that arrive in the mail every few months. Modern technology makes these links possible and allows someone like me on the other side of the world to connect and to care. 3 years ago, in a small, picturesque community of old wooden houses on a beautiful river in the hills outside Ottawa, an organization called the Wakefield Grannies sprang up. It started with one person, Rose Letwaba, a South African nurse, giving a Sunday morning talk in the church by the river. She spoke of the grandmothers in a Johannesburg slum who are raising their grandchildren, all AIDS orphans, in poverty so crippling that the kids' toothbrushes are always locked up. They're that valuable. A dozen Wakefield grandmothers got together and each connected with one South African granny and began to contribute money to that family. There are now 150 grandmother-to-grandmother groups in Canada and the U.S. The book Three Cups of Tea by Greg Mortensen, American climber and nurse, is the tale of a personal connection that has translated into compassionate action. In 1993, Mortensen got lost in the mountains of Pakistan after trying to climb the mountain K2. He ended up stumbling into the small village of Korf. The villagers saved his life and formed a special bond with Mortensen. Haji Ali, the village headman, explained that in Korf, the first time you share tea with someone, you are a stranger. The second time, you are a guest. The third time, you are family. Mortensen became family. His feelings were enhanced by memories of his little sister Krista, who had died after a long fight with epilepsy. He saw her in the faces of Korf's children. Their lives were a struggle, just like Krista's had been. He asked to see the village school, and was taken to a place where 82 children knelt on the frosty ground, scratching out multiplication tables in the dirt with sticks. There was no school building in Korf, and because the village could not afford the $1 a day salary, much of the time there was no teacher. "My heart was torn out," Mortensen reports. He turned to Haji Ali and told him, "I will build a school, I promise." Over the next 12 years, Mortensen and his Central Asia Institute built more than 55 schools, many devoted to girls, in the mountains of Pakistan and Afghanistan. Mortensen points out that for the cost of one missile, we can build hundreds of schools that offer a balanced education. This is a different kind of war against the eternal separation between us and them that fuels extremism. This is a response
that emphasizes the power of compassion and connection. These stories give me hope that we can learn about love, nurture it with our partners and family, and then, with the empathy and courage it teaches us, find ways to take it out into the world and make a difference. Writer Judith Campbell suggests, when your heart speaks, take good notes. These stories began with people being open and responding from their heart to the